I'll continue with Bryn's discourse on the history itself of the course. So yes, it's true, I was sitting there and doing some seva. Doing some worship in a traditional way. I remember looking back and Bryn was sitting up, bright and happy. And a friend was there too, and that's what I do. One of the savers I have where I try to help others is to facilitate people's experience in visiting holy places. Because it's a very, very special thing. Every place has a potency. Right? If you're in New York, you walk down that street, it kind of facilitates the conception that I can conquer the world or get crushed by it. But every place has a potency. And in India, we have that faith that there are special places that have kind of a spiritual potency. One great teacher in our tradition, he made a point that we can reflect on. He said that every object, in Sanskrit that's called a vastu, every object has a shakti or potency to influence you according to what it was created for. So objects and acts of spirituality and devotion impact your consciousness with love. So when you come to these places, if you have the right guidance, people who know how to open the right doors, it's a very wonderful experience. But you can miss it very, very easily too, because it's a question of the right consciousness. So if you have the right reception and facility and guidance, it's quite a beautiful experience, and you're all invited to come. Bryn will tell you, and we have tours and experience. But Bryn was also coming to my classes because I give class there every day, and she was coming to the classes. And I was explaining this morning another class that, you know, we have many teachers, but what makes a teacher? Somehow we understand the subject they're communicating. Think about a yoga teacher you like. They're able to communicate the body and how it moves and enable you to do that in a way so that you can become sukha and sthira. You can become kind of comfortable in your body so you can forget it. A good yoga teacher can help you do that. So somehow we connect with teachers. So there's a very nice connection. And then I remember she was there, and Bryn is an enthusiastic person. It's good quality, actually, rather than being a depressed one. As long as you're not both. So she said, "Oh, I told my friends about you. I told them they have to meet you." I said, "Okay." So I came to her apartment, and that was the time that they were forging the plans for Yogamaya. And then when I came in, she had the inspiration that you should be our spiritual mentor. So we've been working on that, and I feel very connected here. Like real home, because home is where you have so many friends, family, people. I have such connections with just so many people here. Sometimes I don't even know all of them. But you have such nice connections. And it's important in yoga studios because, you know, there's really a thirst for knowledge. Right? You need two things to be successful in any type of endeavor. You need jnana and vairagya. Jnana is the Sanskrit term for knowledge. Vairagya is the Sanskrit term for discipline. Without knowledge, you don't know what to do. Without discipline, you can't do it. So that spiritual addition is very natural for the yoga practice, whatever reason people come. You know, it's very, very powerful. Yoga is in India, there are six darshans. Darshans means philosophical outlooks, and they cover all outlooks. I can even name them here. There's science, Vaisheshika, or animism. There's mamamsa, there's ritual. There's samkhya, there's philosophical analysis. There's nyaya, there's logic. There's Vedanta, which is scriptural analysis. And there's yoga, which is psychology, really. It's how the mind works and how you can control it. Isn't it an amazing thing that to get something to work, you have to control it? And it's very, very powerful. So it's natural when people practice the discipline of yoga, you know what I'm saying, and feel the transformation that happens from just kind of breathing and exercising and controlling your mind, that there's and it's very, very powerful. It's very natural. They want to delve into it a little bit further, you know, and understand the whole tradition of yoga. And its objective and purpose, which is to... Usually, I did it so many times, I won't do it, but I'll do it again. I generally begin the class with three questions, but I'm not going to ask because I asked them so many times. Have you found what you're looking for? Then someone will say yes, maybe they have. But then if it's material, then I say, is it eternal? You know, and if it's not eternal... The test is, if you answer yes, then you become the teacher. Because it's the test of self-realization. So if you answer yes, I found what I'm looking for, and then I say, okay, is it eternal? And you say, oh my God, I just won the lottery, but I can't say yes, it's not eternal. But then if it's like something spiritual, you say yes, and then the last question is, are you always with what you are looking for? Even if it's eternal, you may not always be focusing on it. So this is really such a nice spiritual objective, to really have something that you want and to always be with it. And it's of substance and spirituality, eternality. And so that's the concept in Indian philosophy, and that's very, very attractive. And it has a lot of authority because there's a tradition of it, and people who do it, and people who become transformed by it. So it's natural in a yoga studio, and I'm glad to have this kind of function, both in the sanghas and in my personal relationships with people. So it's called satsang. Sang means to with, to connect with. Sangha is to connect with, to join with. To join with what? Sat. To join with truth. To join with the right values, the right understanding, and the people who have them. It's so important. So, and especially to transform. And you know, transformation generally first begins with a good idea. And generally the good ideas, at least this tradition, comes from the books of tested good ideas. They're called Shastra. The whole concept of Veda in Sanskrit, Veda means knowledge. The whole concept is that with this world there is also knowledge of how it is utilized for the purpose of this world, which is to bring you to that spiritual platform. That's called Veda. Veda means knowledge. So there's the Vedas and there's books that represent that. And in a very, very broad way, because in this kind of tradition, it's not about like a It's not like if you talk about religion in Sanskrit, the word dharma goes so far beyond the word faith. When you look at faith as a particular thought process or spirituality in a particular time, something that can change. Dharma is not something that can change. I'm Christian, I'm Hindu, I'm Muslim, I'm Jewish. It's not something that can change. Religion is the very essence or nature of the soul. To connect with something greater than itself and feel that love of that something which is greater than oneself. It's a very universal conception. It's a very universal conception. It's not sectarian in that way. So when you get good ideas, it can lead to good thoughts. And those good thoughts can lead to... Good thoughts means what? Any yoga teachers can give the Sanskrit for good thoughts? Well, what are thoughts?
Chitta.
What are good thoughts?
Sukha chitta.
What? Bryn, you are a brilliant speculator. Avishta. Yeah, right. You were in the class where I learned this. I often make the point, I sit here because I sit there. I go to classes. I learn from teachers. I went to a class on the Yoga Sutras from a great scholar who was a friend for 40 years. He taught here, Paul Chauvel. It was such a great idea, aklishta vritti. You get thoughts that mold your mind to higher levels of perception and contentment. And this, I make this point, but it's such I got this from the Yoga Sutras, that good thoughts that elevate the mind. When you elevate the mind is very malleable. When you elevate the mind, it means you elevate it to a higher level of clarity. And with that clarity comes contentment. Because the ultimate clarity is you actually see reality, the beautiful, and you're part in it. It's actually an awakening. You actually see what actually exists, not what you're dreaming to exist. You get woken up. So, this is the purpose of classes like this. To represent that. Now, I think some of the students here have heard this last year. What I do also when I come back is I ask Bryn, what should I lecture on? And she tries to think what people need to hear. And in that way, it's kind of a good challenge because I've been doing this this is the third year. I mean, I thought it was more than 3 years that I've spoken, maybe. But... You know, I have to come up with a new class. You know, and so I've become a lot of topics. So she was merciful to me this year. She gave one that I did before. But I think it's so relevant. It's so relevant. I think I can do it in another way than I usually do it. Yeah, no, an interesting thing. When I was preparing this class, you know, all of a sudden I started to think of this person, which I was, like, pretty upset with. But it wasn't an obsession with me, you know? It's not like... But if I meet the person, I feel something. And if I think the person, I mean, no. And all the things that disturb us... You know what I'm saying? Sectarian, judgmental, all these things. Just saying, oh, in your face, everything. And I was thinking, yes, wow, I'm not just teaching this class for others, but I got to work on myself. But it's easy when you have the right understanding. Knowledge and detachment. If you have knowledge, you know what to do. So, and then there's discipline, how to do it. So this is an hour and a half. I probably can do the knowledge part. I don't think I can cure any great ills. But it starts with that. It starts with knowing what to do. Okay, so I thought of a person. Can you think of a person? Once in all my things, I gave this exercise and a person couldn't think of anyone. And then when I looked at the person, I understood the person, I said, they're probably telling the truth. Is that an elevated person? Is that a good thing? You think maybe no one's ever done anything wrong to this person? Or is there something in their consciousness? So, why? I was thinking to myself, why forgive? I can give you the reason why I say. Because I want higher consciousness. Your goal in life should be an elevation of consciousness. Because even if you get so many things, but your consciousness is not elevated, really, what's the use? I told that story many, many times. I forgot who... Oh yeah, I know where I went on TED Talks. And it was a TED Talk called The Happiest Man on Earth. And it was a French Buddhist monk. You see, I learned from so many people. He gave such a nice example. He gave the example of the Dalai Lama getting the penthouse in the Alps with a good view. Right? In New York, you not only pay for the apartment, you pay for the amount of airspace you get. Right? If they can't build for a long while and you get more airspace. So he had a view of the Alps. Wow. Wow, man, I'd love to sit in that apartment. Penthouse. All the amenities. But they asked him, what do you think? He said, it depends on my consciousness. Mm-hmm. If I was depressed, I would see it as a place to jump out. Mm-hmm. So the goal has to be some type of elevation in consciousness. And intelligent people have this kind of objective in their life. And really, if they have enough aklishta samskaras, thoughts in their mind that this is actually good, to get wisdom, to get knowledge, to get devotion, and they hear enough about it, they may make the determination to try to work towards that. So, why forgive? I want higher consciousness. And when I do my meditation, maybe even have time at the end, I don't know, but when I do my meditation, I really, and this is just classical yoga in one sense, there's all these selfish thoughts, and some of them are, you no good, I wish I would like you no good dirty. You know, and other things. When those selfish thoughts come out, and you actually, in my tradition, by bringing up the feelings, it's a little different from this. Anyway, this is Vedanta, and this is my path. The feelings of devotion in the heart, which I feel is the essence of who we are. When I bring that up in my heart, and I try to dwell and live there. I try to dwell and live there. and feel within my heart the budding of the soul, which is beautiful feelings of devotion and gratitude. And I try to distinguish it from those other thoughts. I don't want them anywhere near that, especially the thoughts of hate. Right? And the deepest hate to give, you know, is resentment, because you feel there's a cause. Even the ones that I have justification and cause, I don't want them in my heart, because I want something deeper. I have an objective. That's why I've taken a spiritual path. In our tradition, people go to great lengths. I'll give you another question to begin with. I got to begin, because the class has to also be on a Sunday night, on any night in New York, hearing philosophy at night. It has to be active. If I just make you a slate and just pour all my tremendous... No. It's just not. So I got to bring you in here a little bit. Are you more interested in... when we talk about forgiveness, are you more interested in getting it or giving it? You said giving it. Why is that more important than you than getting it?
I guess I feel like in the past few years I haven't really gotten very
bad. It's a personal thing.
You don't need it.
That's a good answer. Well, one thing I can say is and it's so important to give it. I don't want to get to a definition, but if I thought of really one definition of forgiveness, try to get a good definition, to forswore revenge. Really. You don't wish ill. You don't wish ill for that person. That's a nice definition. I kind of thought, I like to get things succinct. I think that covers it. Forswore revenge. Because when you have that feeling, you want bad for the other person. In some way. I'll share something to you. My mother's a Republican. She's Jewish, so she's a minority, and she lives in a community with people, and people come to him, and whenever she would talk about George Bush, people would tell her he should only get cancer. So, to forswore any ill feelings, it's so tough. And we're going to talk about this most, but, you know, what I'm thinking also, at least, is giving it is really tough. But it's within our hands. Getting it is not within our hands. And in our tradition of bhakti, any feelings of hate are so antithetical to what we want to achieve in devotion that if you've offended someone, you have to get their forgiveness for your bhakti to grow. And I'll just give you like an extreme example. There was one great saint name is Rupa Goswami, and he was in a very, very deep, I'll give you two extreme examples of giving and getting. He was a very, very great meditator. And in our tradition of meditation, what happens is when you chant the name, the manifestation of God has two forms, has two manifestations, the form and the sound. We also heard that from Paul Sherbrow. It's a beautiful verse. So that's why when you say, when in Yoga Sutras, when they say you should Ishvara Pranidhan, then they say, well, how do you do it? Well, the sound. Because the sound is not different than the form. So that actually is God. So you worship by the sound. And therefore, that's your Ishvara. That's Ishvara in sound. And you're meditating. So when you're meditating on these names, in our tradition, it goes deeper that actually the form, the qualities, the activities. So there's very, very deep meditation of what's called lila. And lila is almost like drama of divine love. And there's very deep meditations. So he's in this deep, deep meditation while he's chanting of divine lila. I know people at this level, actually. It's very amazing. When they're chanting, they're at the level of divine lila. It's a drama, a spiritual drama that's just filled with love, and they're meditating on it. So he's meditating on it, and in this spiritual drama, there is a humorous part. So he starts laughing. At that moment, a disabled sadhu, an old disabled sadhu, who's crippled, kind of walks by. And they don't even have crutches, they just have two sticks. He walks by. And he becomes offended. He's laughing. His bhajan breaks. The meditation doesn't work anymore. This is an extreme example. Because he's offended someone. So he goes to his guru, Sanatan, his older brother. He says, I don't know why my bhajan doesn't work. My meditation, he says, you must have offended someone. He said, I don't know who I offended. He said, well, I'll tell you how you find out. You throw what's called the bandar, a big feast. They do this in Indian culture. But there's so many reasons. Throw a big feast. And anyway, I don't want to get off track, but I've seen how much sadhus can eat. I go to these feasts. It's amazing. So he throws in and he said, and then see who doesn't come. And the other extreme, it's true, in our tradition, the person who taught the chanting, who is the teacher of chanting, was born in a Muslim family. So he was ostracized by the Hindus. And the Muslims were really upset about him. And they actually beat him in 22 marketplaces. And at all the time, he was praying for those people. Not only was he forswearing revenge, he was wishing good. Think of a person who you consider saintly. Think of the person that you feel has harmed you. How would the person who you consider saintly, how would they react in the same circumstance? Would they be less hateful than you? So it's a spiritual consciousness. Now, in terms of yoga, you know why it's so important? Again, our friend Paul, it's just when you go to a really good class, so many good points come in. He was talking about the angas, the parts of yoga. And he made a point, what ahimsa is not just nonviolence. Not like you're a vegetarian.
you know, that's ahimsa. Ahimsa is a certain level of maturity of nonviolence. It's an accomplishment of nonviolence. And it even deals with reducing the material desires in your heart, because once you have selfish desires, you're going to exploit others. It goes to your thoughts. And it's such a powerful, and it's in the Yoga Sutras, it's described that, you know, all the angas are connected with that. Or if you look at it as a basic stage, you look at it as the first stage, but in a way, the foundation. You know, yoga means to control your mind. First, you have to control it in relationship to others. So if you haven't achieved a certain level of maturity of ahimsa or nonviolence, you haven't begun to control your mind. What to speak of meditation. So there's a great quote here. Yeah. And for us, I think this is where it begins. Because we have so many altruistic, compassionate, liberal feelings towards so many things, except that person. Right? So we want to begin yoga. You really have to work on these things. Now, let me give a beautiful quote about this. Listen carefully. The shadows of resentment keep our spiritual light from shining through, never allowing us to fully experience who we are. There's a concept of psychology, spiritual psychology, that our selfishness in any form blocks the light of our soul. Even our personality, not personality in terms of who we are, but our passions, righteousness, success, strength, individuality, altruism, when they become overextended, so many things block that light from the soul. And actually, spiritual life means to actually come and understand that and see that and feel that. And you can't. Try to meditate just after that's no good, blah, blah, did whatever they did. In one sense, that's why in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna told Arjuna, don't go to the forest and meditate. Because he was mistreated so much, he would have just gone by this Duryodhana. I'll break every morning. He wasn't ready. He had to do some more. He had to be more active. Be more active. Meditation is very... Okay. Now, I really want to get, because things require definitions to understand. They can't be too inclusive, they can't be too exclusive. Right? What is this? Any definition, I give something like my mind is not working here, but anyway, you have to have a good definition. If you don't have a good definition, what will happen is, in pursuit of something, you'll include things that are not it. Right? Or you'll exclude things that are. If your definition is too narrow, here it is. Here's a narrow definition. What is a devotee? A devotee is a person with clay on his forehead and a shaved head. Now, if that's your definition of devotee, you're excluding so many people that are. It's too narrow. Or what is, you know, or too broad. What is a devotee? You know, something maybe too broad. What is a devotee? A devotee is someone who has been to India. So you'll find people. So you got to get a proper definition. And definition, so we want to do what is it, when it's appropriate, and then the real question, why? Because unless you understand why, you won't make the effort to overcome it. Okay, what is it? Do you like that definition? Minimum condition. Forswore, revenge, temper, resentment, give up resentment, to give up desire to punish, not being it, pardon, overlook, but it's really giving up those feelings of hate towards that person. Okay, when? Really tough one. Let me give you a test. I spoke about this before. There was an incident in Pennsylvania, I believe it was, and some person came into an Amish schoolhouse and murdered 6 children. And when the parents found out, they immediately forgave the person and even wanted to take his wife and take care of the person's wife. When? Is that too soon? Is that good?
Depends on your consciousness.
What? What's that?
It depends on your consciousness.
What?
Depends on your consciousness.
It does depend on your consciousness. You know, the conclusion I've come to is I really don't want to come to the conclusion exactly when. I'm not the app. You know, here it is. These are the things. Offender takes responsibility. A. Anger of victim gone. Unforgivable. Unilaterally bestowed at earliest moment. I'm not sure. I kind of, you know, I don't know. I feel like a little moral outrage is okay. And I don't want people to get confused. You know, no, it did something to my child and I can't, you know. I want them, you know, allow the mother some time. Right? So I like to not really define when, but I'd like to say at the soonest possible moment you should do it. And resentment comes from the Latin word resentir, to again feel, to again go back. Right? I mean, there is a time, depending on the offense. And when that time reasonably comes, don't go back. It's morbid. Don't be on your deathbed. And actually, I saw somebody that I know who had cancer, stage 4. And a friend of mine who I consider really, if you want a person that has such wisdom, it's like just born, has such wisdom and a life like that. And I sometimes watch him, because he's one of my best friends, deal with people. You know, and it's just so, my God, watching the mind, really knowing what to do and how to do it. So he was dealing with a person in stage 4 who was very saintly and was coming to see that person for the last time because they don't live in America. The person is one of the early Hare Krishna devotees, and
That means that some of his friends are, you know, mid-60s, 70s. So he came to America because he never knew if he would see some of his friends again. He wanted to thank the person who brought him to spiritual life and so many people he was coming to see. So he went to see this one lady he was close to. And, you know, wanted to know, is there anything in your heart? Is there anything in your heart for anyone? You know, is any regrets you have, anything? Because this person was very advanced. He did not want, in our tradition, you have to come back to get that person back. Is it so important you to get that person back? Then you have to come back to do it. You know what that means? If I come back, maybe I have to go to PS200 again. Canarsie High School. No! I don't want to be again. Never again. Never again. That competition for sense gratification and all those things you have to go through. And, you know, and if I start thinking about it, I will go into my Rodney Dangerfield comedy thing about how bad life is. Don't want to come back, actually. We don't want to, not only don't want to experience some of the things we experience, we don't want to have the ignorance in which we reacted to them and the lack of knowledge. My father, you know, I came to a spiritual path, and my parents really gradually began to appreciate it a lot. And my father, who's born in Brooklyn and nice, very nice man, passed away about 10 years ago, paid me the highest compliment. He said, "I have three sons, and you're the only one with his head screwed on right." I was just thinking, what's the difference? The difference is this kind of knowledge, this kind of understanding, which comes in a spiritual tradition like the yoga that we're studying, and a tradition which it gives us some understanding and knowledge. So we want to come to a point eventually in our lives of maturity, work through our desires, bhakti, and it's not renunciation. It's dedication, it's satisfaction, the higher consciousness. We want to become pure. Really. We want to become completely loving, and we want to get rid of these things. So I would say when, I don't want to just say, because if I go like this, unilaterally, bestowed at the earliest moment, then we get distracted. You know? Okay, maybe not then. Maybe it's something's really bad, and it's a child or something, and your mother, and you have those feelings and things, or some whatever it is. But you don't want to look back too long. There's one quote here: "Forgiveness means to give up all hope for a better past." Mm-hmm. You got that? All hope for a better past. It's okay. What I'm going to do now is, just because I want it, I really want it, you know, I have limited time and I have an objective, and the objective is to, you know, kind of get you to think through that actually it's something that you do want to do, really, for your spiritual life. By the way, are there any questions so far? I generally don't do this, but I'm learning.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Like, when I think about forgiving a person, I get the thing about I want to have the higher consciousness.
Yeah.
But then there's that other part where it feels like if you forgive someone, it's like somehow you're letting them off the hook, and then in some way they might think they can get away with
that. Forgiveness doesn't mean that someone doesn't deserve punishment. Actually speaking, or shouldn't be separated from society, or shouldn't be locked up.
Yeah, like, but somehow it can feel like, for me at least, sometimes, that it's like my duty to hold the resentment. So that's their punishment. Like, so no one else is going to get... But, I mean, I know that's not right, but if there's something you can do,
it may, if it is your duty, you may be able to do it, but it depends what feelings you want. It depends what kind of consciousness you want in doing it. Right. And I think, hold that, and let's go through the reasons to forgive, and then bring up that question again.
Okay?
And but it's I love the question. It's good. So let's discuss it again.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
So you're saying, when do you forgive? Like, what if it's
at the earliest possible moment?
Let's say it's a repeat offense. Like,
what?
If it's something that they keep doing it, like there's something in someone that continuously just does something because they're not obviously conscious that they're doing it, or, I mean, if they are, that's even worse, but, you know, they consistently do the same thing over and over again, that you're just like...
Oh, well, I have to say, I would say one thing is, it doesn't mean we have to associate with people either.
Right, so then, in a situation where you don't want to associate...
If someone is again and again and again and again, then we can separate from them, and then we can forgive them. You know?
And do you actually have to have, like, a conversation with the person, or can you just forgive them in your own self? Do you know? Like, because it's been time. There's a distance
them in your own
now.
Heart.
Okay.
You don't have to actually say it. It's that's something with you. If you have to get it, you have to speak to them. You had a question?
In the context of forgiveness, what you were saying before about there's like a moral time that you can hold on to something.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that what we're trying to get away from with attachment? Like, shouldn't we let it pass in front of us and, you know, observe it and maybe...
I agree with you. The only thing I'm saying, because there's a lot of people that do agree unilaterally bestowed at the earliest moment. I find when you say that or you define that, then sometimes the class gets distracted from the real issue of forgiveness and you know, gets it in... Because what I feel, at least what I feel, let's say with the mother and the child, I feel it may be part of the mother's love. Some moral outrage is sometimes part of your own love. And you don't want to have a conflict between the forgiveness and the love. You know? So sometimes I feel that out of love for someone, that someone harms that person, out of your love, you may have some outrage. You know? And I want to leave that, because otherwise you can't talk about forgiveness with someone. If you don't grant them that, you'll never get to the discussion of forgiveness. You know. So I give classes whatever people want me to give class on, and I refer to my tradition. I'm not into I'm not like a master of the science of forgiveness. I can actually discuss it from a philosophical term. And I think that's a deep philosophical point. And I think that can take a whole class. What?
Is it real?
I think so. You know, like, because unilaterally, you know, I don't know. In my tradition also, there's a certain type of response that's consistent with devotion. You know, if someone offends someone you love, part of your love is a reaction. You know, you can sit for a while. Then you can think and come back. You know, but I like to think to revisit. You know, you don't go back. Anyway, you know, again, I'm going to go through the reasons to forgive. And some of them may support this, actually. The law of karma may support this. I'll go through the reasons. I'll just... these two questions are great. I really like them. And let's bring them up. Let me discuss the reasons to forgive and see if they cover that. Thank you. A wonderful story when in the civil rights movement... When they integrated one of the first schools in Mississippi, and they brought the federal marshals and matrons, and one couple, civil white right workers, African American, they volunteered their young daughter, 6 years old, to integrate the school. So everyone in that school withdrew all their students, and they protested that day. The girl came marching down, and from the audience, the crowd, they were calling out the most horrible racial epithets to this young girl. Right? And they saw that the girl was like talking to herself. So one of the matrons said to her, "What are you doing?" She said, I'm praying for them." And the matron said, "Why are you praying for them?" He says, I'm praying for them." So why are you praying for them?" She said, "Don't you think they need God's mercy?" So this is supporting immediate. It's glorious. We agree with that? Isn't that better than her being resentful? Okay. Booker T. Washington. "I shall not allow anyone to belittle my soul by making me hate him." Is that spiritual, noble? This again, supporting what you're saying. I was just trying to give a minor exception. When it's not done to you personally, but when it's done to someone connected to you, who's defenseless and things. Because I've had instances with this, where the class stops with mothers. "If someone does something to my child," you know, and I'm going to argue, "No, no, but if they cut off my child, you know, no, you should immediately fix it." It doesn't work. So I just wanted to, it's practical, but I want to support it as soon as possible, if not immediately. Okay, this is a quote: "Anger makes you smaller, while forgiveness forces you to grow beyond what you were." Another quote: "The weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong." Well, this is... "It really doesn't matter if the person who hurt you deserves to be forgiven. Forgiveness is a gift you give yourself. You have to do things, you have things to do, and you want to move on." So that's also a nice concept. You know, I think there's a story, and I think I wrote it down from the Mahabharata someplace. What is it? Hate. When you have hate, it's like trying to throw a burning iron ball at someone. You know, it's burning your own hand. So, now this is interesting. Think about it. The stupid neither forgive nor forget. The naive forgive and forget. The wise forgive, but do not forget. Okay. Okay, let me go through some reasons to forgive now. Okay, and maybe a few exercises. It's good. I'm making my case for forgiveness. If I wasn't a monk, would have been a lawyer. I would have made my case. But in India they say, lawyer means liar. In India they say, but I've been in the courts in India. You have to see it today. Okay. Here's one thing that's really important. First, check to see if an offense was really committed or culpable. I'm going to give some practical things. I want to deal why, and I'm going to give the ultimate reason why. But I want to give all things are spoken at different levels. But this is important. And the criteria for perpetrator, were they ignorant or youthful? What's the culpability? And that goes with the reason of empathy. I know that if I make a mistake, offend someone or hurt someone, I want certainly to be forgiven. I want others to know that sometimes I make mistakes due to my conditioning, but my intention is not to do wrong. I want others to know I try my best, even though I'm not perfect. I wouldn't object if those who I offended prayed for my well-being, and they may have done this before. Therefore, certainly I shall grant that same consideration and mercy to others. See through the offender's eyes to develop compassion. Try to tell it from their point of view. You know, you have to see that sometimes. You know, sometimes people are in very, very difficult, trying circumstances. Circumstances that if you may have been put in the same thing without a mother and father, you know, and treated badly when you were young, you may have had that that anger in you, or things like that. So we have to see it like that. Hypocrisy, okay? Here's a meditation for you. If you were forgiven today by God and others only to the degree that you have forgiven others, how would your life be right now? One great saint in our tradition said that the greatest hypocrisy is when we see someone get mercy. Mercy means undeserved kindness. Like, you know, all of a sudden someone gets success or someone gets whatever it is. You know, without any effort, right? We become upset, right? But every day we're praying for that. Oh, God, you know, give me something. Make me successful. Give me more than I tried. But, you know. But, you know, so you have to see the hypocrisy. You know, do we want to be forgiven? And again, with the platform of ahimsa, unless you're pure, there's going to be exploitation of others. Especially when you don't grow up with a culture of knowledge and training. So, again, I can say that giving forgiveness is in our hands. The real task is getting it, actually. In our tradition, it says even if you don't get it, then you have to go into constant meditation, praying to the divine to change their heart. So, of course, this is just psychological. You should look in yourselves. Is there something in you that makes you unforgiving? Is there a weakness in you that doesn't allow you to actually have that quality that a saintly person would have? I really want to get to the... But I'm just going to... resentment is harmful. There's a story of a teacher. You know how in the classes when they put the pigtails and the ink and all that, throwing spitballs, whatever they do in classes, and kids are so cruel, right? So a teacher got very upset, right? So she didn't know what to do. So what she said is, she had a bag of potatoes, and she's going to do something. We want everyone to take one potato from a person in the room that you don't like. The kids were grabbing the potatoes, and what magic mark is, Mary Lou. Writing the names, you know, of the people that they were resentful to. And she gave each person a bag. Hey, I got 10. I got. And then the thing is, she wouldn't let the kids get rid of the bags until the potatoes rotted. And then the kids were begging to get rid of the bags. And then the teacher made their points. That's what it's like. That's what it's like. I'm not going to go, and I don't have time to go into all the psychological exercises that people do, but there's interesting ones, you know? Maybe we'll do one. Yeah, I'm pretty good. I'll do it at the end. Now, here, close your eyes. How would you feel carrying your resentment another 5 years? How would you feel carrying your resentment another 10 years? How will it feel 20 years from now if you're still carrying this with you? How will you feel if you carry it with you to your deathbed? How about the next life? You see, it's really something we want to give up. So why are we keeping it? Why are we keeping it? Blocking the light of the soul. Now, wow. Saintly people are compassionate. Merciful. What does merciful mean? Undeserved kindness. You think it's a good quality? To give more kindness than a person deserves? Do you want that? Do you want that? To get more than you deserve? You're greedy here. Actually, in a spiritual conception of spiritual practice, in a theistic tradition, you have to get more than you deserve. Because if you have a concept of the divine and you understand what the divine means, it is so far beyond what you can earn by your practice, by your effort. And if you can earn it by your practice and effort, then how valuable can it be? And then is it the divine? So in any spiritual context, mercy and compassion are essential spiritual qualities to progress in any spiritual life. The desire for it. And the hope that the divine is merciful to bridge the gap between what you can pay and what you deserve. Hey, so hey, a little mercy from yourself. Give the person a break. They haven't earned it. They haven't crawled before you. They haven't earned it. Give them a break. And when I was thinking about this person, I didn't even realize it, because you know, so many ordinary dealings and you're out. You know, it doesn't sit with me in my meditations. I don't think about it. But when I thought about it, understanding the knowledge I have, I dropped it. I prayed for their welfare. I gave them my love. And I hope people do that to me. Okay, now, just a little bit more on the philosophical, they're all philosophical, but okay, here's one more meditation. Okay, close your eyes. Meditate on going to a counselor to help you with your resentment. Okay, lay down on the couch. The counselor is sitting there.
and the counselor is speaking to you to help you with your resentment, then meditate on yourself as the counselor. And you're now the counselor. And give yourself reasons to forgive. Okay, you can look up. Did you convince yourself? Now, I really just want to get to the crux. Philosophically, from the law of karma, what has come to you is in you. And actually, all Indian schools of thought, even they have different philosophies, they all believe there's a moral force in the universe that's pushing to a higher level of consciousness. And they all believe in karma. And what karma basically means is that what's coming to you is in you. And the reason it's coming to you is so you can identify what's in you. And by condemning what's coming to you, hopefully you'll condemn what's in you. Karma is a very, very intricate law. I give a whole seminar on that. Maybe we'll do that seminar again, because there's new people on the psychology of karma. We work with astrologer. Just to show that there's it's very interesting, because you can show that it's a law. That at your birth, certain things are going to come to you because they're in you. And that's a helpful one. And I'll give you a personal example. You know, there were some people that were really giving me a hard time. Nasty. There were really people that were giving me a hard time. Right? And I went to the same wise man, right? That I told you went to that lady, and when he went to the lady, he wanted her to think of anything, any desires, any people that you have a relationship problem. Give it up, because you're going to have to carry it. So the person gave me an exercise. Okay, I'll give you the exercise. Okay, this is what he did to me. He said, okay, close your eyes. Okay? Now, think of that person who's harmed you and really, without inhibition, express all the feelings you have, like that, no, whatever, and express those feelings. Really, express those feelings of the heart, what you feel for that person, right? Now what you do is look at that person's face. First, really let it out, what you feel. The hate in your heart. Just let it out. Let that person have it. Now look at that person's face. And now replace it with your own. And keep the feelings going. Okay. I'll tell you why the wise person gave this exercise. And you can look up. Because he knows that I am thoroughly faithful and understand the law of karma. And completely understand that what comes to me is in me. Right? And sometimes what happens is you see that person delivering that of giving you the gift of rectifying yourself.
the most spirit. There's a famous story in this Mahabharata, the history of India, where this saintly person, as nice as you can give, his name is Vidura. He's so saintly that when Krishna left the world, there's a story how Krishna leaves the world. He's asking, where is Vidura? Where is? It was in Krishna's heart. He's so saintly. But his nephew thought he was, because of fratricidal war, thought he was doing politics and cursed him out and put words in his heart. Heavy. They say that criticizing someone, that criticism is worse than envy. Because envy is when it's in the heart and criticism is when it comes out. Criticism is worse than throwing a spear through someone's body. Because criticism can pierce the body, but words can pierce the heart. So he said, you know, the most nasty thing. And then not only that, kicked him out of the house and the kingdom. And he was the king now, this guy. So Vidura, you know, he looked back. And then he saw that this person is under Maya illusion. It's called the external energy of God. But then he saw, the internal within the external. Because he saw God was using that person's Maya to give him a message. So the person sometimes that is harming you, you look beyond it, and there's some lesson or message that's being given to you to help you come to a higher level of consciousness. In the karma class, I sometimes put the papers out like this that I give, like three or four papers, and okay, this represents 5 years, periods, right? So here you are now, right? God comes, takes you back 20 years, right? Now all these papers now represent the horrible relationship problem you had with that person, the financial difficulties, the sickness, right? Okay. So God says, I'm going to take you back and let you live your life again. I'll remove all these. But with them, I will remove the lessons that you learned from them. So the question is, would you rather have them or not? Most people say, I'd rather have those circumstances because of the gifts of realization that they've given me. And if you could go back with knowledge and respond to them in a more insightful way to learn even more. So in that kind of simple way, karma, you understand that what's coming to you is somehow connected with you. Somehow, to make you grow. And therefore, the great saint Bhishma Dev said, if one understands three things, there's no cause for despondency, no matter how trying circumstances in life can be. He said, if you understand that what's coming to you is absolute, and it has intention to elevate you, if you bow down to it, doesn't mean you don't try to do anything to it, but these are the things that are beyond your control. You bow down to it, you respond in the appropriate way, and you do it under guidance, you will extract the realization that your destiny is giving you to help you grow. And generally then people won't trade that, those experiences. If they knew it's a divine plan to actually give us happiness. There's an experiment that's done with a frog of the hot water and the boiling water. They put some frogs in with the hot water and some frogs in with the boiling water. Right? The frogs in the hot water died. The frogs in the boiling water lived. Why? Because in the boiling water, they immediately jumped out. In the hot water, they went,
and it killed him. So it's sometimes like that. We have a certain comfort zone, and we think, oh, I wish everything would just stay the way it is. But we're not evolving spiritually. We're not getting deeper in our consciousness. Life is tough, and then you die. We're not going deeper. And sometimes when it's the difficulties, when you have some spiritual acumen, it forces you to find your happiness, not in your destiny, what happens to you, but how you react to it. And ultimately, happiness will be consciousness. We have to go to the platform of consciousness. Anybody here read Viktor Frankl's The Search for Meaning? Never read that book. It's considered one of the 10 most influential books. It's about a psychiatrist, a Jewish psychiatrist, psychologist or something, that's in the Holocaust. And it's really, you barely can read the book to understand the suffering that he underwent. I mean, you can't, I mean, I can't even practically repeat it. You think that you have difficult times, you know, like hard labor, freezing cold, no clothes, you know, it's just amazing. You know, brutal people taking care of you, you know, and he wrote the book, The Search for Meaning, of even in that circumstance. That more than sensual and egotistic satisfaction, people are searching in life for meaning more than anything else. And the real happiness in life will be finding that purpose and finding that meaning, which is ultimately spiritual. So even if you, sometimes I feel sorry for Bill Gates. Because you realize how much he has going to lose? How fearful he must be? Now I'll do a little local vernacular. You ain't got nothing, you ain't got nothing to lose. Okay, now I'm going to give what I think is the ultimate reason why we should forgive as soon as possible. Maybe if you have the consciousness, someone can do it immediately. Why you should forgive. And I got a quote. But I'm first going to explain the philosophical point. That our mind is malleable. And according to the mode or shape the mind is in, that's how you feel, actually speaking. So real intelligent spiritual consciousness, you're concerned with your environment and you're concerned with your actions, because they will affect your consciousness. And what Dharma is, it's a science of appropriate response to your world. It's the science of appropriate response to your world that will mold the mind to a higher level of perception and contentment. You make the wrong choice due to the wrong idea, klishta. Troublesome thoughts, troublesome samskaras. The mind gets molded to a lower level of perception. You make the right choice, even if it's difficult, whether it's tolerance, whether it's forgiveness. The right choice is called Dharma, and the right choice will mold the mind to a higher level of perception and contentment. Why should we forgive? Because it's Dharma. It's the correct thing to do. And it will ultimately be beneficial for you. So here's the quote. it's not just a therapeutic matter as this was just about you. Rather, when the requisite conditions are met, it is what a good person would seek because it expresses their ideals. These include spiritual growth and renewal, truth, mutual respectfulness, reconciliation and peace. It is a moral quality. So ultimately, we think about these things and we try to implement these things. And if you need psychological help to do it, fine. If you need exercises to do it, fine. It doesn't justify what a person's done. It doesn't make a wrong a right. It's basically about you. And what's the correct thing? And I believe that there is science. There's science of behavior. There's science of response. It's called Dharma. And Dharma leads to auspiciousness. Do the right thing, life will get better. Last, I will end with a story. You tell me if you agree or not with the person. There's two Brahmins. They come to a river. And a scorpion somehow jumps on the man's, one Brahmin's hand and bites him and then falls in the water. The man picks up the scorpion. This is a very elevated saint on the highest level of ahimsa. Ahimsa means, did I write that down yet? I think I wrote it down someplace. I got that definition also. Did I write it down? Yeah, I wrote it down someplace. One second. Ahimsa means, so many points I got from that class I went to. Ahimsa, to not want to offend any creature in any way at any time. That's the perfection of ahimsa. So he was really an elevated. So he picked up and it bit him again. And then it fell in the water and he picked it up and it bit him again. And when he got out, the other Brahmin said, "Why did you pick up that scorpion? Don't you know that its nature is to bite?" He said, "Yes, his nature is to bite. But my nature is to forgive." Okay? Any questions? Yes?
So, if you have to, in order to forgive, do you have to kind of like make up a lie to yourself that the person who offended you is of a narrow mind or ignorant? Is that wrong?
Are they?
Well, it's only your perception, so how do you really know?
What?
How do you really know?
Well, I mean, if a person is immoral, it's ignorance. Mm-hmm. You know, they're in the mode of ignorance. It means light is not shining through their consciousness. They lack lucidity. They can't see things clearly. They are ignorant. Otherwise, a person who sees clearly, who actually sees things clearly, they can perceive things clearly, they're immoral. They actually can make the proper distinctions, the proper understandings, what to speak of. And they understand all these things also. You know, the person is actually, has lost their free will because they're in the mode of ignorance. They're practically, you know, can be almost like an animal. You know, they've lost their consciousness, they've lost their, you know, that's part of the symptom of ignorance. I don't think you kind of have to make it up. It's actually true. You know,
What?
That's good.
What? Yeah, and there can also be compassion, because understand that the person who is the perpetrator, if you see, suffering is actually the greatest suffering is to go against your nature. Our nature, and this is the bhakti tradition, our nature is to love. So people who are perpetrating, they're going against nature. Even if they're in an advantageous position exploiting others, they are suffering. That's why there's a law of karma, because God's merciful. For those people who perpetrate things, the same thing will happen to them. That's God's mercy. I'll do it with the... People like when I say this too, but the ancient system of Brooklyn hand language. Because what happened once, this is true, I gave a lecture in the most prestigious school in India like 30 years ago. And I had it, you know, make, you know, explain things with my hands, which I do. So I said the ancient system of Brooklyn hand language, right? But what happens sometimes is, it's a cultural thing, Indians don't get my jokes. So they actually took it literally. So the next day I see myself in the paper with a big picture. Dhanadhar Swami demonstrating the ancient system. Okay, well, here it is. You're going to see it.
Okay? Oh my God.
This is the way it works, the law of karma. This represents the perpetrator, and this is the victim. Right? Now, what's happening here, this person is actually going against their nature of love. Now, there's Vishnu. Vishnu means God who's all-pervading. And what Vishnu means, he also manifests in Sanskrit and in the cosmology as time. So in time, what will happen is this person who is the perpetrator will be the victim. Of what? They'll be the victim of the same thing, right, that was in them. Right? So what happens in this circumstance? The person says, I don't like it. But what are they not liking? They're not liking actually what's in them to some degree or another. And therefore, you know, it's very difficult and interesting, but with some spiritual acumen, we can take the different circumstances that come to us as vehicles for our evolve and to actually learn, if that becomes our objective. But if our objective is, you know, the same thing, we don't like it because, you know, it reduces our control or things like that. So yes, it's what's going to happen to whatever person who's done something to you and is not intelligent to get your forgiveness, right? They're going to have to suffer the same thing they did to you. That's the law of karma. They will suffer. That's why I'm interested, if there's even a hint of anybody I've offended, to get their forgiveness. Because you see, when you do something wrong, right, if you can repent, you can get rid of it. And with this four stages, you can repent. If you can't get rid of it by that, then you can atone. You do something to counteract it. Right? Let's say you do something. This is the system. You can know that I forget. There's four of them, and I forgot what the fourth one is. There's, you remember? You apologize, right? Something wrong. If you apologize and the person accepts your apology, they can be alleviated from the reaction. If they can't, then you have to repent.
then, you know, somehow you don't. Then you have to perform atonement. And then if you don't do that, then you have to suffer the reaction. So actually, the person is very much dependent on getting that forgiveness. So there's a certain sense of compassion. It's not an advantageous position to perpetrate something on someone. It's a hellish condition. And in every way, that person suffers more than you. They're already suffering more. Actually, because if someone has done something so bad that you feel, wow, like that, and it's actually true, you know, what is their consciousness? Okay, things happen, we lost money, we get cheated, relationship breakout, all these things that happen. But ultimately, happiness is consciousness. What has that person done to their consciousness? And the person, even if something happens to them, responds in the appropriate way, their consciousness becomes elevated. I say easier said than done. But you know, this is yoga. This is people who have some spiritual objective to something. Otherwise the people are not coming to class. They want good ideas. They want to create favorable impressions in the consciousness. Very difficult. Because we're dealing with psychology. There's some scars that get put in. For certain people. Hey, they cause me pain. You know, then we have a samskara. I enjoy doing harm to them. It may be very powerful. I want revenge. It may be very powerful. It's not easy. That's my next seminar. Yoga psychology. Is there therapy in the Vedas? You can find it on wavesofdevotion.com. Is there therapy? It's yoga psychology. It's how the mind works. And wow, what it takes to actually make us free from the ego. What a job to actually give us happiness, to actually give us love. Tough. Okay, one or two more questions, and then we end. Because I am a person that's punctual. You already went 15 minutes over. What?
Okay. This is a comment. I have a comment.
You want to make your comment?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that. And I think sometimes we are offended by people.
Yeah.
And have. You know, we need to forgive, but we're offended not necessarily because they did something wrong, but because we might have misinterpreted where they were coming from. You know, and so we're holding grudges against people when, you know, they weren't even coming from a malicious position.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. One of the things I did mention that we first have to see the culpability, the first thing. Okay, Kadamba.
Yeah. I was wondering to what degree does this apply to forgiveness of the self? And like even in the case where perhaps you don't even necessarily want, like maybe you don't do something to somebody else and they're angry at you, but maybe you just do something and you realize it was stupid or it was unbecoming or something.
I mean, to forgive yourself.
You can't let it go for yourself.
Yeah, that's number six here. I didn't cover that. Thank you. Well, self-forgiveness, well, I forgot my points on this at the end. I said for wrong done to others, well, you really can't do that. I forgive myself for chopping his head off. No. For what that wrong has done to you, what that wrong has done to you, and what one has done only to oneself. You know? Yeah, we can forgive ourselves also. But not for what we've done for others, but what one has done only to oneself.
But I guess I wonder too, like say, you know, I do something to someone and they've forgiven me, but I can't necessarily forgive myself for what I've done to that other person.
Well, if they forgive you, you can be gracious and accept their mercy. Really, we have to accept mercy too. We have to accept kindness too. Okay, I'm going to end because I like to end on time. Okay? Thank you all very much.